Wrapping up a brand new week and kicking off a brand new month on Friday, March 1st, 2024, on Connecticut Today, where we wrapped up the Michelle Trakonis case and the verdicts with University of New Haven senior criminal justice lecturer Ken Gray. Former Derby Fire Chief Chuck Stanky joined us to talk about the 49-year mark since the infamous sponge rubber fire in Shelton. And former Democratic State Rep Chris Caruso of Bridgeport stopped by to wrap up the Park City's mayoral race and discuss the current state of any proposed election reforms at the Capitol in Hartford. First, though, we continue our analysis earlier today of Michelle Trakonis being found guilty on multiple charges in connection with the death of Jennifer Farber Dulos, the apparent death. Her body has never been found yet, remains never been found, and a judge declared her dead. Michelle Trakonis guilty of conspiracy to commit murder, two counts of conspiracy to tamper with physical evidence, two counts of tampering with physical evidence, and one count of second-degree hindering prosecution. Joining us right now, senior lecturer, criminal justice and all that, Ken Gray from the University of New Haven. Ken, with a long criminal justice and national security background, including years in the FBI. Ken, it's Paul here. Thanks for joining us. How are you?
Hi, Paul. I'm doing great. How are you?
Hi, I'm good, Ken. Great to have you on and to analyze this. Were you at all surprised by the six guilty findings or not?
Paul, you can never tell how a jury is going to end up deciding, but I am happy that the way that this has turned out. Now, after nearly 5 years, we finally have justice for the disappearance and murder of Jennifer Dulos.
What technically, Ken, if you can put it in plain language for my audience here, conspiracy to commit murder? I think it's important to keep telling people who may not understand. She wasn't found guilty in the direct killing, the apparent ending of Jennifer Farber Dulos' life. But what does a conspiracy charge mean in this case?
So in this particular case, this does not mean that she herself had to do anything, but that she assisted in some fashion in the murder of Jennifer Dulos. That is, she did not have to be present. She did not have to do anything herself to actually affect the murder, but she had to conspire. She had to work with at least one other person to make this happen. So Michelle Trakonis conspired with Fotis Dulos by providing him an alibi, by helping him get rid of evidence. And so it shows that she had to know that he was going to murder his estranged wife, and that she took steps to help him do that in some fashion.
So essentially, Ken Gray, if she knew that, you know, her lover here was going to do this, she would have been in the clear if she just said, hey, no, like, get out of here. Like, even if she went to the police, right? The fact that she apparently, Ken Gray, did nothing to stop this and then maybe assisted him in getting rid of some of this evidence, that was the kicker, right?
So the fact that she was part of the alibi, that is, she sat there at the house in Farmington with his cell phone, waiting for a call to make it look like he was there in Farmington, when in actuality he was down in New Canaan murdering his estranged wife. The fact that she was there afterwards and went with him to dispose of evidence, those things show that she was an active participant in the murder. That's how she conspired, was that she assisted him by providing him with that alibi. It's not something she did after the fact. It's something she did with him planning to do it before the murder took place.
Also, Ken, again, was watching the coverage of this, including our news partners at News 8 and all the stations again, Ken, highlighting the role of how law enforcement, state police, local police, FBI, and all these levels were able to piece together this video timeline of essentially following the vehicle from Fairfield County all the way up into Hartford. And I guess, Ken Gray, one of the real incriminating pieces of evidence here, video-wise, against Michelle Trakonas was a couple of quick peeks of her as she opened the door to wipe her hand on the ground while Fotis Doulos was, you know, way away from where he would have lived and where he would have normally been, disposing bags of what we were later to find out were bloodied clothes and cleaning supplies.
Yeah, the video up in Hartford there showed them on Albany Avenue disposing of pieces of evidence in that area, and she opens the door to block the view of another vehicle, and she claims she was blocking that she had opened the door to wipe gum off of her hands on a public sidewalk.
Yeah, who does that?
That's something most people do that, right?
Yeah, right.
Right. What a strange thing to claim that that's what she was doing. But by doing so, she has the door open, and that is covering the view of Fotis as he is back behind the vehicle, placing a package with altered license plates into the sewage there. I believe that's what he was doing at that time.
Mm-hmm. Ken, now, John Schoenhorn, her defense attorney, one of the best defense attorneys in the state, high-profile guy, a fascinating guy to listen to. In his post-verdict comments today, one thing that he really focused on, Ken Gray, was some of these initial sit-downs that she did with local police, and he claims this should have never happened. It was improperly done. And I guess, Ken, that kind of laid the foundation here, and with all these allegations of this was legal, this was illegal, she still, despite her age, is not really good with English. So what are your thoughts on that?
So she, in many ways, talked herself into being prosecuted. That is, normally, if you are a suspect in a case, you're represented, your attorney's going to say, don't talk to the police. Instead, she talked to the police, and then she lied to the police. She was interviewed on three different occasions, and her story changed. She said that she was in the shower, and Fotis Doulos joined her in the shower the morning that he was down killing his wife. That story, of course, changed to where by the end it was that he was not there. She had not seen him. So in many ways, it was not a language barrier. She was lying at the time.
Ken, somebody asked me this here at our station, and I was wondering about this, and maybe you can fill us in here. So she's facing, I guess, X amount of years, you know, 50 years, whatever it is, on this charge, this conspiracy to commit murder charge. Is she, Ken, liable to any further prosecution? If she gets to jail, let's say the appeals don't work and she gets to jail, and she makes contact in some way with the Farber family and says, okay, I know where the body is. Like, I can take you there or give you a good idea. If she, and again, this is assuming that she knows more than they'd be willing to say, does she open herself up to any further criminal prosecution or not?
Well, there is a pending possible charge against her for viewing evidence that was on a laptop that she was not supposed to see, and so there may be further charges brought against her. But as far as being able to exchange information, that train has already left the station. Mm-hmm. It's way too late for her to be able to try to make a deal like that. I'm not sure it would even be in the state's interest to talk to her about that for consideration. She has not been sentenced yet. So if she were to come forward with something to offer before the sentence, that might be taken into account.
Mm-hmm.
But there's another shoe to drop in this case.
Sure.
That is, Kent Mulhenny is still out there.
Yeah.
He's a co-conspirator. And, I think the outcome of this trial is very important to him. If the state had not managed to win this case, they may not have brought. They may not have taken Kent Mulhenny to trial, but since they succeeded in this, they got the verdict that they wanted. then we're going to see this all play out again with Ken Mahaney.
Yeah, well, so if Mahaney says, well, wait a minute, you know, hey, guys, forget conspiracy. I can prove that she took part in the killing. I mean, then what happens, Ken?
Well, she's already been convicted in conspiracy to commit murder.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that she's exposed for anything more along those lines. He might be able to trade location of the body for consideration, but we will see what happens with that aspect. But we will see a replay of a lot of this again here when he goes to trial.
All right. Senior criminal justice lecturer, former FBI agent, retired, long career in criminal justice, national security, Ken Gray, University of New Haven. Ken, always a pleasure, my friend. Thanks and take care. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Paul.
Appreciate it. Ken Gray there. All right. So that's one thing I was interested in finding out. What if she, in some maybe warped moment, says, all right, let me come clean. If I ain't getting out for 30, 40, or 50 years, I guess she's 49, and she could get sentenced, assuming the sentencing goes ahead of schedule and is not derailed by any possible appeals on a number of cases, number of grounds. She could be looking at 40, 50 years, maybe not getting out if it ever happened, till she was in her 70s or 80s, approaching 90. So she says something. Or, as Ken Gray just said, remember, and I neglected to mention that, this Kent Mahaney, who's an attorney, well, not anymore. Well, I guess maybe he still technically may be. But he was, I think, Fotis Doulos' attorney at one time. And they say, you know, there's allegations that he was in the middle of all of this. So once again, thanks to Ken Gray. All right, we'll get back to open phones in just a bit later on this hour. When we do that, 203-333-9422-333-WICC. Our next guest is coming up on 50 years of service as a volunteer firefighter. He joined the Pawtucket Hook and Ladder Company in Derby way back in 1976. He served multiple terms as captain, coming up on 50 years of membership and active firefighter service. He was the fire chief in 1991 and 1992, on scene for many of the major fires in the valley, including, of course, the Sponge Rubber Fire, which happened 49 years ago. He's been on the program before. Chuck Stanky is here. Hey, Chuck, it's Paul again. How are you?
Very good, Paul. Thanks for having me. How are you?
I'm good, Chuck. I'm getting along. As long as I get out of bed in the morning, Chuck, as long as I can walk, everything's good. You know what I mean? I'll figure it all out.
I hear you.
Chuck, does it feel like it's been almost, 49 years now, almost five decades since the Sponge Rubber Fire? Can you wrap your arms around that it's been that long?
I can't believe it's been that long. I can remember it just like it happened yesterday. I remember it in great detail. But, you know, as time goes on, we all get older and time passes.
So the exact date, 49 years ago, lay this out for our listeners. Now, I'm sure, Chuck, if they're of a certain age, they either remember this or it's been told to them by their parents or grandparents, or maybe they even lived in the area. But I remember as a young teen this huge blaze, the news coverage it got, the what ended up being found as the cause. So lay this out for us.
Yeah, it was on March 1st, 49 years ago. And if you knew B.F. Goodrich, the Valley, not only Shelton, but the Valley was a big industrial age at that time. And B.F. Goodrich plant was the one of the biggest industrial rubber makers, mattresses in Shelton. If you drove over Route 8 and you looked down, it took up the whole downtown of Shelton that was there. And on that evening, I remember it very well, because we just got done having an awards dinner at one of the fire stations in Derby, so I had just arrived home. And like I said, it went off. The FBI considered it one of the biggest industrial arson cases in the country.
So what was, so you got notified how? Were there sirens? Did you have a beeper, a pager? How did you have the fire department radio? How did you find out about this, Chuck?
To tell you the truth, I found out about it because I heard the explosion out my house. I went to the back window and looked outside and saw the entire, because I could see Shelton during the normal time, and it was all aglow. It was all orange. But almost immediately, the fire tone started hitting in. And again, I come from Derby, but a normal response, we were on a normal response as mutual aid partners to Shelton. So if any alarm went in over there, whether it's fire or not, we responded. But this was massive. As soon as you looked out, you could see that this was big.
How quick did it take you to get on scene, Chuck? And you got on scene and you looked at it and said what?
Well, I looked at it and said, holy cow. And again, I was a young member.
Yeah.
You know, I had just started. And this was the kind of stuff you saw on TV. But it was all aglow. We followed. I happened to didn't make it to the fire truck in the station. The fire truck was just pulling out of our station.
Yeah.
So I followed it over. And our station is directly across the street, across the river from B.F. Goodrich. So, I mean, from our fire station to actually getting at the fire, all you saw was this massive ball of flames, a big orange glow. And, you know, you're wondering, oh, is anybody hurt? Is what's going on here? You know, how are we ever going to get this out? I mean, before it was even done, there was over 75 departments that had responded from throughout the state to extinguish this.
Mm.
It took well over a week to get everything out.
A week. Well, now, when you get there and you're fighting, and I know the technology is different today, but with 1970s, late 70s, almost 1980 technology, was water pressure ever a problem there, Chuck, or not?
Actually, it was not a problem, and I'll tell you why. Because right along the river, all the engines started pumping. We hit the hydrants and got water out of the hydrants and out of the water mains back. But a canal ran underneath the road there, and they call it the Canal Street.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I really remember is Shelton, the Echo Hose Company, had a 1938 Aarons Fox pumper.
Wow.
They rolled out of the firehouse. It was out of service, but they rolled it out of the firehouse and drove it to the fire. And that pump for 2 days out of the canal in the street. They had covers over the canal in the street. They lifted up the cover and put the hose in, and that pumped a massive amount of water to feed the – at the time, they were new fire engines at that time, this 1938 pumper.
Mm.
They used to call it Jumbo.
Wow. Now – you know, fighting, and by the way, Chuck Stanky is the guest, past Valley Fire Chief, and he was one of the first responders 49 years ago today to the Sponge Rubber Fire. Now, Chuck, you know, machine shop fires, house fires, garage fires, that's all well and good. I mean, that's one thing, but you guys and gals responded to some place that obviously simply by what they were making there, Chuck, I would imagine you had to know of some very caustic and toxic chemicals that were in there, right? Did you guys have an inventory, or were you guys kept abreast of what was in these factories?
Absolutely. Like I said, we used to train there and drill there and respond on drills with Shelton, and it was foam rubber. There was chemicals in there. You know, just rubber is a petroleum product. It burns very hot, and that's where you see that thick black smoke. And it was there. And they had planned this out very well. They had placed bombs, which were 55-gallon drums of gasoline, on each end of the building and one in the middle. The amazing thing about this whole fire was that no one got injured. Nobody got hurt or killed in this fire.
So this was arson, right? Explain the investigation and the origins of this, because I do remember years ago reading about this, but explain the, you know, basically the basic criminality, Chuck, that went on here.
What it was the owners of the company had firebombed this place to collect insurance.
Mm.
And what had happened was they had, again, like I said, it was a big industrial area. Just after the second shift, the plant was full. The second shift had just gotten out and released home, and there was three people left inside. There was two maintenance guys and a boiler man, and they were inside the building. And what had happened was when they were making their rounds, they got kidnapped by these arsonists that were there. And they took them, they covered their heads, and they eventually brought them, took them away and brought them and dumped them off in the woods in Monroe, stating to them, listen, don't do anything. We don't want anybody to get hurt. We're not here to hurt you. And they made a mention of, they said, did you ever hear of the Weathermen? And that was a radical group at the time.
Yeah.
And that's all that was ever mentioned. So now all of a sudden, these guys, they asked them, did you ever hear of them? They said, no. He says, well, you'll hear of them now. So that's where that theory came out of trying to make, I guess, an alibi
or
blame for the arson. But it turned out that it was never a terrorist or a radical group. It was these gentlemen that were hired by the owner to burn down the company for insurance money.
And in the years after that, Chuck, now we're decades better about detecting chemicals and remediation and cleaning that up. What was the legacy of that? And now that's, I guess, Riverwalk. The cleanup there must have been, once this fire went out, you said it burned, parts of it burned for a week. What was the environmental legacy here, if any?
Oh, again, at the time, we didn't have brownfields, per se, like we have today, and we didn't have the technology to detect all these hazardous materials that we can today. So we just did the best we could when we brought in. The state fire marshal was there, the Shelton Fire Marshal's office, and, of course, environmental protection, both federally and state DEP were there. They were worried about we had to check runoff, because we put massive amounts of water in it, and this factory was right on the river runoffs. They had to test the water in the Housatonic River, which was right there in the canal and stuff. But they got through it, and like I said, they cleaned it up, and now it's a beautiful park. There's a veterans park there. They call it the River Walk there for Shelton, and there's parks. And across the street, they put in a couple factories, and there's a market there, and now it's a real nice area.
Chuck, I can imagine how many times what we just discussed that you've gone over with generations of younger firefighters. So you must bring this up in the training, I would think, over the years.
Oh, absolutely. We train. You know, you learn from what your past experience where we train in hazardous materials. And, of course, nowadays everything is artificial. There's no more stuff made out of natural products or wood. Everything is byproducts. But yet not only train firefighting, putting it out, but also now decontamination of cleaning you and getting the contaminants on you. But also it was a great training ground, and I've attended several arson training seminars. I'm a certified fire investigator with the state of Connecticut, and that is brought up is one of the great training grounds to prove it was arson. They had delivered. They worked all weekend bringing these barrels of gasoline in and wiring them up with Detcord to bring them off. And the guys themselves is installing a new telephone system, so nobody questioned it.
Because, you know, Chuck, it's funny you say that. I'm saying to myself, now I'm just a dummy flapping my gums here on the radio. Nobody noticed this? Hey, guys, what are you doing? Oh, it's a 55-gallon barrel of gasoline with wires. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, no, the guys themselves out is bringing in, you know, wiring up a new telephone system.
Wow.
And the 55-gallon drums were commonplace there because that's how the chemicals were delivered to process the rubber that was in there. So, you know, bringing in 55-gallon drums was nothing out of the ordinary. The out of the ordinary was wiring them up, and that's how they guised it, is installing a new phone system. And we were, myself and the members of the Pegasus, knew of that plant a little better because at the time the plant manager was the late Joe Iacone, who was the fire chief from the Pegasus at the time. So he was intimately involved with that plant. He knew the ins and outs of what was there. And he had often walked us through the plant just to see what was in there and what would happen if that went in. But again, the massive fire was so big that it was fought strictly from the outside. Nobody went inside to put this fire out.
Well, Chuck Stanky, thanks for recounting that for us. 49 years ago, I remember. I was like 13 or 14, and Chuck, I remember, and you probably do too, even back then, you know, long pre-internet, long streaming this or videos here. I mean, when I saw that on the local news, it was like, wow. And just, you're right, Chuck, just that mass of flames. I said, oh, my God. And friends of mine that lived in the valley at the time were like, I can't believe this.
Yeah, and it was, like I said, you could see it for miles. And I said, you know, when I looked out my window and driving to the firehouse and to the fire, actually, it lit up downtown Derby, wow. Shelton, and Route 8 goes right over it. I could never even imagine somebody driving over to Route 8 Bridge when that thing let go.
Oh. Man, yeah, it's amazing nobody was hurt or killed. Chuck Stanky, yeah. Chuck, good to have you on again. Stay in touch, my friend, okay?
You too. Tell your engineer, Christian, I said hello.
Oh, let me tell you something. This guy's a Swiss Army knife, Chuck, let me tell you. All right, Chuck, thanks. Be good.
All right,
thanks, Chuck. Yeah, 49 years ago, the sponge rubber fire. Man, I just remember watching, the film. This was pre-videotape, watching the film on Channel 8 and this massive fire going, holy geez. All right, fourth and final hour of this week. Thanks for hanging out with us right here. WICC 600 AM, 107.3 FM and online, of course, on your digital device at WICC600.com. What do we have? Your computer, your laptop, your desktop, your notebook, your netbook, your tablet, your phone, wherever you want us, you can bring us in, including this gentleman, every Friday, right about this time, to take a look at things statewide and locally and to wrap things up. Chris Caruso's with us. Chris, oofa, four rounds done. Are we finally done? Mod on. Oh.
Are you ready for the weekend, Paul?
Oh, my God. Jeez. Well, listen, kudos to Mayor Ganim. You know, Chris, you've run. I mean, it's tough enough to run once. Four times, Chris, in 2 months.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's exhausting on resources, on the candidate himself. You know, I know Joe, and I've spoken with him, and it takes the toll, no question about it. And but he won handedly in this last election. 60% of the vote, and it's over. John Gomes conceded. Joe Ganim is the mayor, and you know, hopefully we'll see 4 years of productivity. Hopefully we'll see a legacy that Joe Ganim sets, and a vision for the city with a strategic plan to move the city forward. I think the city is in a pivotal position now where it can move forward, create great things for its citizens, and also get support from the surrounding towns. But you know, it's yet to be seen. I always hope and am optimistic that things are going to get better and stronger. And, you know, I also think even though it was four elections, I think it taught something to Joe Ganim, to the people of our city. I think it taught to all the candidates running that the people want change and they want to see positive things done for the city, as I do as a longtime citizen of Bridgeport.
And, you know, Chris, Bridgeport, I mean, even back to the days of when Donald Trump wanted to put a casino here, Trump wanted Bridgeport and Steve Wynn wanted Hartford, and we know that never went anywhere. But you can still see, Chris, okay, the proposal for the soccer stadium and the amphitheater and the new Fillmore music venue coming in and the continued improvements at Steel Point with the apartments and the condos over the city. It's not that Bridgeport is unattractive. It's quite the opposite. The location at the intersection of the highways with access to the ferry and the trains. I mean, there's no reason that Bridgeport should not succeed. There's no reason.
No, exactly right, Paul. And, you know, over the years, it's frankly been a lack of vision, lack of a strategic plan. You know, developers come in every day and they want to do something, but the city doesn't have a vision or a plan of where to put developers or areas of the city that we need work on and support of. And I think that's what's been lacking. You know, you look at Shelton, you look at the Valley, you look at surrounding towns, there's a vision of where they want the city to go. And Bridgeport, unfortunately, has been void of a vision, void of a strategic plan. I've had this very honest discussion with the mayor about it, frankly, over the last couple of months, that we need to see a vision for Bridgeport. I think he's aware of it. He understands it. I've offered my services at no charge. Wherever I could be of help, I would. You know, you've got two beautiful theaters, the Palace and Majestic Theater, that need to be renovated, need to be reopened. You know, the Fillmore could go in one of those theaters. There's no need to go and build another theater. You know, we have them already. But that's all part of the vision of how we make it work. I think the soccer field that's being proposed, soccer stadium, I should say, I think is very positive.
Yeah.
I think the city can develop around arts and entertainment, around recreation. There's a lot of positive development that other cities across the country have made miraculous turnarounds. And Bridgeport, frankly, it's our turn to do that. But we're not going to do any of that unless there's a vision that's created by the political structure of the city, but also the business community and others in the city that are of interest to do it. So, you know, it's all yet to be seen. And I think that's something yet to be told. But even on a larger note here, the corruption that we've seen in this and these elections, the defrauding of the people of the city of a fair election has to change, Paul, because that has a perception to people outside of Bridgeport as to whether or not they want to do business in Bridgeport.
Yeah.
And, you know, and what you've been reading about the legislature and different legislators and the secretary, it's all called legislative speak. you know, I'll translate it for you because I was 20 years.
Really?
I hear you, but I'm not throwing out a lifeline, okay? And partly it's because of the system. And there are some things we can do. And let me tell you, and flash to the Secretary of State, it is not, and I repeat, the drop box is the problem. It's the people that are robbing the election using the drop boxes to defraud the people. So you can set up times. Maybe you could have a hiker in that area. You could set it up as a freedom trail, whatever you want to set it up as, or a historic trail. It ain't going to work. There's some basic things you have to do. And here's some things, because I went to a January forum of the legislative body in Bridgeport, and I was very passionate about changing. Here's some things that came up. One is to extend the statute of limitations. So when state elections enforcement investigates a case and they find criminal charges, it can go to the Secretary of State. Right now, it's only a year, which is not enough time. We've seen that with the 2019 investigation. Extend it out another year. So when they find criminal behavior, it goes to elections enforcement, so people are prosecuted. Another thing we could do is limit the number of absentee applications that any one individual can take out. So they can't take out 100, 200, take out five. That's it, five. And if they take it out and give it to someone else, there's a $500 fine because they have to sign out on the bottom. So if an investigation comes up and someone's caught giving the application to someone else, $500 fine automatically. That's going to be a deterrent. Jail time for people who break the law, critically important. This nonsense about when the applications go out and when they don't is just that. Because you saw in the last one, the judge set a limit of when it had to go out, the applications, when you could start distributing. You had the same number of absentee ballots as in every election, 2,200, 3,000 taken out. So, you know, rude awakening, it isn't the time that you put out the applications. It's how you do it. And there's a series of other things that we can do to restrict the abuse of absentee ballots. Now, the question is whether or not there's the will of the people to do it, right? And that's and let me tell you one other thing, because it's gotten me so angry.
I can tell.
It's gotten my agita up that you can't manage. Okay,
Chris, get out the Briosky. Go ahead. Yeah.
Oh, you better believe. I'm going to tell you. I'm yelling at the mayor at home. I'm so angry about it. You had every elected official in the state of Connecticut come out for Joe Ganim, right? And they have the right to come out to whoever they want to come out to. And they were all Democrats. And I think it's fine. You want the Democratic nominee, God bless you. You have a right to do it. But they were all quiet, said nothing about the absentee ballot abuse. None of them talked about reforming the system. Okay? The governor said he wants reforms, but didn't talk about what those reforms are. The lieutenant governor said nothing. Chris Murphy said nothing. Okay, so they all went and they endorsed the mayor, which was fine, that they have the right to do that, as I said. However, it was deafening, their responses to the absentee ballot abuse. None of them said we need to correct the system. And on top of it, the day that they had the rally to get out the vote for the mayor, and all those elected officials were there, a couple of people got up to speak who were alleged absentee ballot abusers. They're the ones that are being investigated. Now let me tell you, I've been a longtime Democrat. I've been the Democratic town chairman of Bridgeport. There can't be anyone more Democratic than me, okay? But when do you start policing your own? When do you start cleaning your house? When do you start speaking up to say that the system, the way it works, and the absentee abuse has defrauded the people of this city and the good people of the city? I'm not talking about the criminals who robbed the ballots and screwed around with senior citizens and people with disabilities. I'm talking about the good people who come out to vote all the time and do it because they believe in the system. And I tell you, I was on Facebook and I made that comment that I know all these elected officials personally. I've worked with them. I've helped them get elected. I've done everything humanly possible because I believe in them. But I was amazed at the silence.
Oh, yeah. Crickets.
You better believe it. So I'm holding them accountable. I went to the legislative forum that took place, and I held my Bridgeport legislators accountable. And they all were giving me this legislative speak. You see, the problem is everyone else in the room never served in the legislature. I did. And so when Brian Lockhart says in his article, well, it takes time for change, that's legislative speak. Because when I was in the legislature and I became chair of the GA&E committee, which is the committee that does the reform of election law, the public financing I did in 1 year. It was lingering for 20 years. It was defeated time and time again. I got in, and in 1 year extended, we even met in the summertime, we got it passed. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to hear people telling me they can't do it. That's all excuses. That's all it is.
Yeah, okay? And Chris, the last three rounds of this four-round calliope we were on, the last three rounds, apparently, now there were, I guess there was some controversy with a dozen ballots or two or three here and there, but it showed that you can do it relatively cleanly now, pretty much because you had people watching. And Chris, just to wrap up on this, I want to get your final thoughts. I hear the word or the term or some machination of disenfranchising again, I think I'm going to put my head through the studio window here. Chris, it's not that hard to vote. Newsflash here.
No.
It's not that hard. But when I hear this, whoa, we can't disenfranchise anybody, please stop that. Stop.
No, yeah, and Paul, you're right. It's nonsense. I went voting. And I was with all different types of people, ethnically, racially, everyone. Everyone showed their license, okay? In Connecticut, if you don't have a license, you could show two bills that you get at home. You could show your UI bill, you could show your gas bill, and you're allowed to vote. On top of it, if they don't let you vote, you do a challenge vote. You can vote there, and you can challenge it. But believe me, this is all nonsense. What it is, It's people who want to get elected, and they don't want to change the system too much because the system benefits them. That's what this is about.
Yeah.
But the bottom line here is the defrauding of the people of Bridgeport who deserve an honest election. That's all it is. And until I go to my grave, I'm going to be speaking about it. I've already been making calls to legislators. I probably will travel to Hartford, and I will fight this. This is ridiculous, and it's. And the responses have been deafening. It's like they all look there and they're all looking for someone else to do something. You know, Manaja Diallo. You know, right?
Manaja. Right, my mother
to hell, right. To hell with the devil.
Yes.
That's just, you know, this is. Right?
It is. Chris, listen, I know you're worked up. So listen, you now that you're so passionate here, I'm going to allow you to have a nice spumoni, and you go and have that, and you have a nice little coffee with Anna Zett, and that'll calm you right down. All right? How's that?
Well, you know where I'm going to dinner tonight because it's Lent?
Where?
I'm going to Vinny's Pizzeria, which is on East Main and Huntington Turnpike.
Nice.
And they have a delicious bowl of escarole and beans. Okay?
Right,
so I got my provolone up, and now I'm going to go and have something nice to eat.
And, you know, when I was growing up, you know, whether it was scottole and beans or whether it was minestrone or Italian wedding, you know, my parents and grandparents used to say, and they used to call this peasant food. The hell it's peasant food.
My mother used to make me pastini and egg and oil, you remember?
Oh, my God.
And we had that almost every day. Today you go out and it's $7 a bowl. Back then, you know, how much does pasta cost?
And they give you portions where you look at and say, really? Yes.
And then you go to the real upscale, the highbrow Italian places. Pasta fagioli is
$14.
Yeah.
All right, Chris. I got a scoop. Enjoy dinner, Chris. Take care. All right.